There are millions and billions and trillions of them, and they are everywhere, in our air, on our food, in our mattress. But after we smash one with enough force to knock over a baby elephant, we pause to ask, can insects be sentient?
Welcome to the award-winning Food Chain Show with your host, Michael Olson. Now, get ready for an hour of What's Eating What Radio.
Well, hello out there. You are tuned into the 685th edition of the Food Chain right here on News Talk Radio. Or hey, perhaps you're among our friends over there in Paphos who are tuned in as we stream along on the Food Chain page at metrofarm.com. Well, whoever you are and wherever you are, welcome aboard. I am Michael Olson, your host for this hour of What's Eating What Radio, with engineer Nikki James on the boards. Hello, Nikki.
Good morning.
Producer Carol Stafford on the phones.
Hello.
Folks, this from Insectopedia by Hugh Raffles. There are too many insects, uncountable numbers, more all the time, and they are so busy, so indifferent, and so powerful. They almost never do what we tell them to do. They'll rarely be what we want them to be. They won't keep still. In every respect, they are really very complicated creatures. If what Hugh Raffles says is true, we simply must ask, can insects be sentient? And who better to ask than Hugh Raffles, who is the author of Insectopedia. Hugh, welcome back to the Food Chain.
Thanks, Michael. Great to be back.
Boy, 7 years.
Come faster.
Yeah, time flies. Hugh, last we talked about your book, In Amazonia, and so my first thought when I saw your book, Insectopedia, was that you were in the Amazon and you got fascinated with insects.
It's not far from the truth. Yeah, I did. I started paying attention to them a lot more than I had done before, I think.
And the reason, of course, is because there's a lot of them to pay attention to down there.
Exactly, and they don't really leave you alone either, especially at certain times of year. There's times of the year when mosquitoes and similar kinds of biting, flying things are so thick in the air that you just can't move.
Well, Insectopedia, it's not really an encyclopedia in the sense that you go from A to Z bugs, but you go from A to Z stories, and you're kind of like... I've come to think of you as an amazing travel writer. Is that far from the truth?
Well, I'd be happy to be thought of as that. And there's a fair amount of travel in the book for sure. Yeah.
For sure, you traveled around the world collecting insect stories, and it took you to some very interesting places, some of which we hope to cover today. But tell us a little bit about what the Insectopedia is.
Well, I think of it now as a book, really, yeah, I agree, a book of stories about encounters between people and insects in all different times and places. So some of them are the stories which go back to the 11th century, and then there's stories that are very contemporary as well, and they're in all different kinds and places, all different times and places, like I said. But all in all, I hope that it builds up into, you know, a varied picture of the very complicated and incredibly varied ways that we interact with insects and the ways in which we're so dependent on them and so mixed up with them that our lives are so entangled with theirs, and the planet is really, life on the planet is really a story not so much of us. I mean, in some ways we all live very independently and indifferently to each other, but we're also so closely involved with them and so, like I said, dependent on them, and that's part of what I'm hoping that people will get out of reading the book.
Well, I was reading Insectopedia last week while sitting in on a college graduation ceremony. You know, it was a stadium filled with people, and I was sitting there waiting for the proceedings to proceed and reading Insectopedia, and the people around me were going, Insectopedia? Ew! Which kind of led me to think about how we usually interact with insects, and it led me to one question. You know, it seems like, this might seem like a bizarre question, but it's been bugging me, if you'll pardon the pun. Whenever someone smashes the bug, they seem to do so with enough force to knock over a baby elephant. You know what I mean?
I mean, I do.
Pow!
Yeah.
Why... It doesn't take that much force to squash a bug.
Right.
Why do we put so much force behind that?
What is that? There's some kind of satisfaction about killing an insect, and it's the only the only living being, I think, that we do get satisfaction out of killing. It's not just that we're excused from any of the consequences of killing another being, but we actually get this satisfaction out of it, and I'm not quite sure what explains that, because they're not, in most cases, they're not hostile to us, they're not predatory on us, they're not dangerous to us. I mean, there are some insects that are dangerous to us, you know, for disease carriers and what have you. But in general, yeah, I agree, it's completely, the force we use is completely disproportionate, and we get some kind of pleasure out of it as well in many cases.
Yeah, and that's what kind of captured my fancy. I was thinking if somebody could put together a video loop of people smashing bugs, you know, it would be pretty interesting stuff, because it's just ker-pow and yay, and then it's jumping up and down.
And it's something about the way that, perhaps because they're in general so tiny, and we don't feel the kind of connection to them that we do to mammals, where we think that we're related to them, or we can see some kind of relatedness in their faces or their eyes, or that we don't even think of them as, it's more like a challenge to kill them than it is that we're killing something that's got some sort of equivalence to us. People in general tend not to even call insects animals. I've been really struck by this as I've been talking to people about the book, that one thing that people say to me is that they're surprised that I call insects animals. And I'm thinking, well, what else would you call them if you don't call them animals? They're clearly, you know, they are animals. They're not plants. They're not fungi.
Right, right.
But they seem to, you know, occupy a category of their own. And maybe that's partly that if we don't call them animals, we don't think of any kinds of continuity.
We can't touch base with them then. Yeah. Well, let's talk about the kingdom of the insect. And let's take us to the air above Louisiana, which is kind of how you open Insectopedia. And give us a notion of what's out there, because insects are small, you know, looking out the window, generally speaking, unless there's one on the window, we don't really see them, and yet they're out there by the trillions.
They are, and I was actually very happy when I came. I've been looking for something that would capture that sense of how many they were and how separate they were from us, how there was all this intense life going on that we weren't very aware of in most cases. And I came across this, there's some story, I suppose, of how in the 1920s, scientists who were concerned about, they were in the Department of Agriculture, and they were concerned about the damage being inflicted on cotton crops by bollworm moths, they tried to figure out how the insects were dispersing and how they were migrating, where they came from.
Is this really one of the first times we tried to come to grips with what these insects were? Because they're attacking our economic crops, so we're really going to sit down and figure out what's going on here, try to get a handle on this.
Well, yeah, and that's really the basis of entomology as a science as well. It comes out of interest in tracking insect pests and insects as some disease vectors. And before in the 1920s, what they started trying to find out where insects were at different altitudes, so they started sending planes up. Before that, they'd been trying to get information from people who are working or traveling to areas of high altitude, so people who, like mountaineers, they would ask them to see what they were finding when they got up to the tops of the mountains, or lighthouse keepers, they'd ask them to collect what was going into their lamps and stuff like that. But in the 20s, they sent up these planes, and it was from Louisiana, and they had them fitted with sticky traps under the wings, and at different altitudes they opened the sticky traps for a certain amount of time, and then they came back down and they counted what they'd got. And really they were somewhat shocked by what they found, because they were tracking way more insects and way more diversity of insects than they expected, and at much higher altitudes than they expected as well. And many of the insects, probably the greatest proportion of them, I think, were actually wingless and flightless.
You mean they're wingless and flightless insects at high altitudes?
Well, yeah. I mean, they would find spiders, for instance, at up to 15,000 feet.
Wingless spiders at 15,000 feet?
Yeah, and at first they thought these were just tiny little animals that were just getting blown away and were just up there, just getting blown around. And then over time they figured out that really it wasn't quite like that, that actually the insects could position themselves to get to get blown away, or to get caught up in the winds and then carried up into the air currents, and they could also organize themselves and position themselves to come down more or less where they wanted to come down. So they're actually, they started thinking of them as traveling. So you get some that migrate, like locusts migrate, and other, you know, some butterflies, as we know, migrate, and certainly know in Santa Cruz, eh? But also a lot of these insects that would just use the air currents to,
sail the seas, as it were.
Yeah, and to, I mean, they recognize spiders that can circumnavigate the globe, or have circumnavigated the globe on the air currents.
Wow.
And these people estimated that above any square mile of Louisiana countryside, if they took an air column that went from, I think it was 200 feet to 14,000 feet, something like that, there would be between 25 million and 36 million insects in the air at any given time on any given day.
Lots of bugs. Folks, this is The Food Chain. Michael Olson here. We're talking with Hugh Raffles, author of Insectopedia, and you right back. Do stay tuned.
Get this. The average acre of farmland in or near the city limits may earn in excess of $123,000 per year. To learn how so much can be earned from so little, pick up a copy of MetroFarm, the guide to growing for big profit on a small parcel of land. MetroFarm is the PMA Ben Franklin Book of the Year Award winner by Michael Olson that contains over 500 pages of photos, charts, checklists, illustrations, and in-depth interviews. MetroFarm will teach you how to develop a strategy, survey markets, select crops, organize business, establish production, prepare for market, and make the sale. MetroFarm will teach you how others just like you earn a good living by growing high-value specialty crops for people who are truly appreciative. Abraham Lincoln said, "The greatest fine art of the future will be the making of a comfortable living from a small parcel of land." Get in on that future today. Pick up a copy of MetroFarm at bookstores, lawn and garden supply stores, 1-800-624-BOOK, or at www.metrofarm.com.
Well, here's an interesting thought. In the air above 1 square mile of Louisiana, there are approximately 36 million insects flying around, floating around. 36 million above. Is that right, Hugh?
That's right, and they all seem to be going somewhere.
I mean, they're traveling too.
They're traveling, yeah.
But what does it mean when it says from which falls a continuous rain?
Yeah, because they're also coming down. They're not just up there floating around hanging out. They're also landing, and it seems like they start off. They're looking for something. They're looking for new habitats, new food sources, mates. Who knows what it is? But they're just looking to travel. Who knows? But they're going up, but they're also coming down.
36 million insects, and that's just above the ground.
That's right.
And there's insects on the ground, and there's insects under the ground. So Hugh Raffles, author of Insectopedia, whose world is it? Theirs or ours?
Probably depends where you stand, doesn't it?
I guess so.
Yeah, I think it's all our world. I really do. We couldn't survive without them. We'd be choking on the masses of hair and dung and feathers if they weren't there. Decomposing and breaking it all down, we wouldn't have the food that we have, because we wouldn't have pollination, as everybody knows so well now, because of colony collapse disorder.
Right.
It would be a very, very different world, I think.
So it's both of our worlds, and much as we like to smash them with enough force to knock over a baby elephant,
right,
we can't live without them, and that's just the bare fact of life. It's they're part of our world, and without them, we wouldn't be here. Fair enough?
I think so, yeah. That's certainly how I think about it. And we have to, I suppose, think of disease and as pests as part of the world as well. And we can try to control those things as much as we can, but we probably have to recognize that it's not really controllable. It's part of the way that it's part of the consequences of living in a world that has some... that's so diverse and it's made up of so many creatures, and that also these are consequences of the way that we've tried to control the world and organize it as well.
Well, Insectopedia is really not an encyclopedia of insects. It's really a compendium of incredible stories that you collected from about people and insects around the world and around time and throughout time. And So let me run down the list here of some of them. The flies of Chernobyl, the wasps of Provence, the crickets of China, the flies of the laboratory, the dance of the honeybee, the locusts of Africa, the bugs in videos, cockroaches in New York City. I thought what we do is pick a story and go there with you, or have you take us there, so people can have the enjoyment of experiencing your travels and your discoveries. So I thought maybe what I would do is pick a story here, and of course I would go straight for the Dance of the Honeybee.
Okay, that's great. And this story is about Karl von Frisch, who was the Austrian biologist who was the first person to identify that bees communicated through dancing, or honeybees communicated through dancing. People have known for centuries that somehow if bees found a patch of flowers or nectar or food resource of some kind, very soon other bees would also show up there.
Sure. How do they know that, you know? One bee discovers something sweet and they go away, and then in another moment there's all kinds of bees there, so...
Exactly, yeah, through observation, I suppose. Mm-hmm.
So we've known forever that bees have this capability, but previously to Mr. Frisch we thought it was what?
People didn't really know. They just, I think they thought there was some kind of communication going on, but they didn't really have any idea how it happened. I think they maybe thought it was scent, or... I mean, that's a good question. I'm not really sure of the answer of that.
Mm-hmm. They just did it, right? And we don't know how, but we'll... We just, this is the way of it, and that's that. What did Frisch discover then?
Well, by close observation and some fairly simple experiments, he worked out that bees were communicating through what he called dancing.
How did he experiment? What kind of experiment would he do?
Well, he would track bees to hives. He would number from hives to sort to food sources. He would put out food sources with sugar water. Mm-hmm. And he would number the bees that arrived there, and then he would follow individual bees as they went back to the hive. And he created these observation hives which had glass down one side so that he could see what was happening inside the hive. So he would observe a particular bee go to the sugar water and drink, and then go back to the hive. And what he saw was that other bees would gather around it very, very close, and that bee would then make these movements, and he'd see those movements repeated by other bees. That was confusing. So he'd see that bee make these movements, and then other bees, the bees that were around it, would then travel to the They would know where to go, and they wouldn't just have to follow that bee. And I think this is one of the things that people had thought previously, that a bee would act as sort of as a leader, you know, like as a scout who would take the bees to the, you know, directly and personally lead them to the source. But in this case, they didn't happen, because there'd be some kind of communication of information. And von Frisch saw that it was in the movement. And he'd also see, obviously, he'd see lots of other bees doing the same thing, and the same kind of community of bees form around a bee that was returning. So he then started to look very, very closely at the movements that they were making, and he did what he called decoding the language. He started calling it a language, and he set about what he called decoding it. And he thought there were two different kinds of dances, a waggle dance and a round dance. He called them
a waggle dance and a round dance.
Yeah, that referred to, that indicated different kinds of different information, that conveyed different information to the bees.
Mm-hmm. I was thinking that people do that too, you know, waggle dances and round dances.
They do, but probably for different reasons.
Yes, probably.
Yeah. He thought that one of these was for sources that were very close to the hive or to the nest, and others were for more distant ones. But now it seems that that's probably not the case, that was maybe an artifact of his experiments. Because, of course, you know, now with all kinds of technology and film and whatever, it's much easier to slow things down and look in more detail at what's happening. So people, I think, have been able to make more fine-grained analysis of what the bees are up to.
So this is kind of like people making this realization that there was a different level of existence being displayed here than we had thought previously, right?
Definitely, yeah, definitely. And there were all kinds of, or there have been all kinds of attempts to explain it in different ways. So people who are not sympathetic to the idea that there is, that animals have intelligence or sophisticated cognition, tend to explain this as a very set of a set of very inflexible commands that the bees provide. So they act in a very conventional way. So they find something and that then triggers this reaction. And it might be more complicated than we would normally expect from animals. This would be the argument they make, but it's still very inflexible. And bees aren't capable of adapting to change conditions, and wouldn't adapt their communication to change conditions. Other people who are more sympathetic, I think, to animal intelligence, think of it in a very different way and really do see flexibility in it, and think of it maybe not as close to human language, but as something that's different, another form of communication.
Sure.
It's probably only part of the many kinds of communication methods that bees have.
Well, so not only can a bee tell other bees where the food is, but they can tell other bees how good that food is.
They can do that absolutely, and it seems they do that by the intensity of their dancing. And there's some very interesting things about this, I think, such as, for instance, bees don't necessarily act on the information that they get. So bees
uh-huh.
might crowd around another bee, and it comes in and it dances, and then it appears that, well...
No sale.
Excuse me, sorry.
No sale.
Exactly, yeah. Sometimes they'll go off, sometimes they won't.
Okay, so folks, this is the Food Chain. Michael Olson. We're here today with Hugh Raffles, author of Insectopedia. We're talking insects and bugs. Which bugs bug you? Right back. There are millions and billions and trillions of them, and they are everywhere. In our air, on our food, in our mattress. But after we smash one with enough force to knock over a baby elephant, we pause to ask, can insects be sentient? And by golly, you know, it seems like bees are reasonably intelligent. They can talk with each other and tell each other where to go, and they can try to sell each other things, and they can refuse to buy those things. So they seem like remarkably sociable critters. Are they sentient? What do you think out there? We're at 800-624-2665, 831-4798. We're with Hugh Raffles, the author of Insectopedia, a compendium of stories about people and their critters from around the world. Hugh, I took a survey of the crew here,
mm-hmm.
and producer Carol Stafford wants to hear about the crickets of China.
Okay.
And engineer Nikki James wants to hear about the locusts of Africa.
Okay.
So let's start with the crickets of China, kind of a fascinating thing to me. I was a student of Chinese language. I, of course, became aware of the importance in Chinese culture of the cricket, but have never really understood it. So maybe I'll learn here, too. Why crickets in China?
Well, I have to say this is my favorite part of the book to write, and it was based on some time I spent in Shanghai talking to people who were involved in training crickets to fight and in generally participating in, I'm not sure if you'd call it a sport or a hobby or what you'd call it, but there's been a really long history of people pitting crickets against each other. And there's a written tradition of this. So there's there's even a cricket manual that people still use that goes back. It was first published 900 years ago.
900 years ago?
900 years ago, yeah. I know, this is really a long-term thing.
Uh-huh.
And that gives, you know, detailed instructions on how to care for a cricket, how to raise it, just generally how to look after it and prepare it most effectively for fighting.
Well, what is it about the cricket that makes it an attractive proposition as a pet? Because they're tiny, and probably do have a significant amount of drama, but because they're tiny, you know, people crowded into China, you know, could have them as opposed to like pit bulls.
Yeah, and I don't know if people have pit bulls as well, but maybe that's something to do with it. It's also, I think, because they're tiny, like you say, you really focus on them, and you have
mm-hmm.
this, you know, when you're watching them, you're really concentrating on them, and I think maybe that increases the drama as well.
Mm-hmm. So there's a whole world built up around cricket fighting, with books that go back 900 years. And, of course, I suppose they have all of the paraphernalia that goes with that, too, right?
Yeah, beautiful, beautiful things, actually. Little cricket pots that, and some people collect them and have very varied collections of them. Some, you know, people make them now, of course, because it's still really thriving. But also these little implements for caring for the crickets, little, like, marriage chambers that people call them, that they put male and female crickets in for sex.
That got a giggle out of Carol. So I could see people carrying their cricket chamber down the street, right? So you actually got involved in the cricket world in Shanghai and in the outskirts of Shanghai. Tell us a little bit about your adventure there.
Well, I met people who were very experienced at training crickets, and so learned a lot from those people. They would tell me what, you know, everything that they did and how they looked after crickets and show me things. And it's actually, when you don't know much about crickets and you're just being shown these things, the details are so tiny that it's very hard. Well, it's very hard for me anyway, at least at first, to really see the differences, even between what people think is big differences, like difference in color between crickets. People classify crickets according to different colors, and it was very hard for me even to tell the difference in colors. But then it gets much more specific than that. So tiny differences in the energy of the cricket, the strength of the legs, the shape of the wings, this kind of thing.
And given 900 years to work out details, there's probably a lot of details to work out.
A lot of detail. And, you know, as you can imagine, there's all kind of websites and, you know, discussion sites and all this kind of thing where people are really working on those details and trying to figure out what it is that determines how you can tell a really good cricket, a good fighting cricket, just by looking at it.
Are there, like, cricket masters who are well-respected all around the country and people do pilgrimages to see them and stuff like that?
That's a great question. I don't know about that. I mean, there are people who have sort of positions of authority as being particularly well-respected people who really know a lot about it and have written about it or have... Or organize tournaments and this kind of thing. And
tournaments?
You have there's sort of two different worlds of cricket fighting. There's a sort of public exhibition, sort of like exhibition matches of cricket fighting that some people organize, and they're organized through university in Shanghai and through there's a cricket museum in Qibao, in a suburb of Shanghai, and then there's also, I think, a much bigger world of, which is underground, of cricket fighting for money, for gambling.
Oh.
And to me, that's probably what explains why it's such a big deal and why it's so successful, because there are hundreds of thousands of people who are involved in this and participate in it. And it's really because, I think, not just because it's really compelling and exciting to watch the cricket fighting, and because people are so into the, you know, figuring out this stuff about the cricket.
And when you have some skin in the game, as it were,
exactly.
It makes it even more exciting.
Exactly, yeah.
Exactly. Kind of like any sporting event.
Yeah, and there's a significant amount of money that people put into this, too.
So did you actually see crickets fighting? actually observe this event?
Yeah, I worked with a really fabulous translator who was great at just getting us into networks and getting us some set up with people, and eventually we got taken to a couple of cricket matches in some housing projects outside in the suburbs of Shanghai, and that was it was very very intense, I guess is the word that I'd use for it. These weren't the really sort of high rolling punters kind of cricket gambling places, but there were places where I suppose more regular people went and they betted, but still significant amounts of money. Mm-hmm. And people would come from outside Shanghai. There were people who come from other cities because that particular gambling house was quite well known. And the matches would go on through the night.
And were these legal, or was there kind of a black market about it too?
No, anything involving gambling isn't legal, and people put themselves at significant risk in doing it. There are periodic crackdowns on gambling and on cricket gambling, and people have been executed for running gambling houses and cricket fighting houses over the past few years. So it's a serious business, and there's significant security. People are pretty very, very careful about how they how they organize these things, and it's pretty much a closed circle of people who come, as you would expect.
And that made it all the more exciting for you, right?
I suppose so, yeah.
Looking over your shoulder to see if the police were going to come and arrest you?
Well, it makes me more, you know, worried about being responsible, so that, you know, my presence isn't drawing attention to something and isn't putting people in danger, really.
Right. Folks, this is The Food Chain. Michael Olson. We're talking insects. And we're talking people and their insects with Hugh Raffles, author of Insectopedia. When we come back, we're going to go to Africa and talk about locusts. Right back. Do stay tuned. Welcome back, folks. This is The Food Chain. Michael Olson here. We're talking insects with Hugh Raffles, author of Insectopedia. Do you think those insects that you squash like a bug can have sentience? Can they be knowing, feeling, thinking beings? Are they just bugs? What do you think? 800-624-2665, 831-479-1080. We've talked about the crickets of China. We talked about the dance of the honeybee. Let's go to Africa and talk about locusts. And they have locusts there periodically that pretty much rule the world, don't they, Hugh?
They do. When they come in a swarm, they can just completely overrun and devastate a rural community in a village. It can be very, very devastating for people. And there seems to be nothing that people can do about it at all. And when I spoke to people who had memories of having been in a village that had been overrun, it was really quite a shocking story that people would tell about just they'd see the animals coming, they'd see a swarm coming, and then there'd be nothing at all they could do. Everything would be overrun, and they'd have no choice really after a couple of days but to leave and abandon the village.
Leave
and they lose all their crops and everything.
So they just swarm periodically. How often do they swarm?
You know, this is a very interesting thing. It seems like not that often. I talked to a biologist in Niger who's been tracking this by looking at all the historical records over the last 200 or 300 years, and I think he's found something like 38 major outbreaks in the last since the 1750s, I think, something like that.
So periodically, then?
Periodically, yeah. So periodically when they come...
Maybe, what, once a decade or something like that?
Yeah, but not to the same place each time. Probably a bit more than that. Probably a bit less than that, I would think.
Mm-hmm.
And not to the same place each time. So it would be, you know, a particular part of a country could go for, you know, 50, 60, 100 years without having to deal with this.
So
but on the other hand, people are really struggling more every year with other kinds of grasshoppers, some of which are locusts that don't swarm, mm-hmm, or don't reach a swarming level.
What's the difference between a locust and a grasshopper?
Well, locusts are grasshoppers.
Ah.
But locusts are grasshoppers basically grasshoppers that swarm.
Okay.
You know,
so then they're just grasshoppers whose population explodes and then they swarm.
Yeah, when the population gets large enough, and it's not quite sure what triggers it. It looks like it might be density or some kind of contact, like rubbing up against each other. Or
it always works that way.
And then they just get going,
uh-huh,
and they can travel these huge distances, and they can do it really fast, and they eat anything in their path at all.
And it's hard for people who have not really contemplated this issue to understand the devastation. When you say they eat everything, they do eat everything, don't
Absolutely,
they?
Absolutely, yes. Plastic, cloth, plants. They're pretty voracious, I think. They don't really leave. They don't leave anything in their wake. And there's so many of them. They're just yeah.
They just eat everything, and everything's gone. So what do people do? I mean, is there any way of managing this?
Well,
this plague of locusts.
Well, the problem is that you need to manage them very early in their development. So you need to actually manage them before they swarm. So what people try to do is they try to monitor them when they're massing. They try to monitor the large population groups before they swarm. But the difficulty is that the places where the populations develop tend to be actually almost exclusively places that are very, very difficult terrain and very, very, mm-hmm, very remote. And they're often off limits to the kinds of monitoring organizations that are in place, either because they're too difficult environmentally for them to get their equipment into, or, as often the case, because they're war zones.
Genghis Khan, they swarm out of Mongolia to take over China.
Once they swarm, there's not a lot you can do, and they that's the problem. They arrive too. People start paying attention to them too late, or they just can't get the resources there to deal with them. So with locusts, it seems to be a question of having the infrastructure in place and the resources devoted to it, but then there are these political problems that really get in the way.
Yeah.
So in Niger, where I went to do this research, it's in the north of the country where there's been a rebellion for the last very active way for the last 10 years probably, and that's the area where the locusts are likely to come from, and it's more or less inaccessible to the monitoring organizations.
So nobody can keep track of it because they're out there in Mongolia,
exactly.
And nobody can touch them. Well, the big question for me, of course, to come out of your book and the incredible work that you put into it is, can insects be sentient?
Right.
And one of the things that really got to me was your piece on crush videos.
Mm.
What the heck are we talking about here?
Well, these are videos that I guess they're a form of porn video, really. They're films of women, usually either in shoes, and it's women filmed from the knees down, probably. Who are treading on small things, and in this case, what I was writing about was treading on insects.
Mm-hmm.
And there are men who just get off on that and watching the movie. So there's a very small market in this. It's a pretty specialized thing.
But it gets me back to the question of, you know, why we use such force to kill a bug, to squash an insect, and to the big question of, can insects be sentient? And that's the question I want to explore with Hugh Raffles, author of Insectopedia, in the very few minutes that we have remaining in the show. So do stay tuned for that one. It should be very interesting. What do you think? Do you think insects can be sentient? Do you think they can know and think and be? Right back. Do stay tuned. So that's the question. Can insects be sentient critters? That's the question on the table for this edition of The Food Chain. Mike Lolson here with Hugh Raffles, author of Insectopedia. But before we get to that big question, let's go to Rich, who has an interesting question, perhaps dating back to the segments we did on locusts. Rich, welcome to The Food Chain.
Yeah, hi, Hugh. Michael, I was curious, of all the insects that you've had a chance to investigate, which ones are the most tasty, if you've had a chance to find that out?
The most tasty?
Yes.
Well, you know, that's actually the other part of that chapter about locusts, because as well as having to deal with them invading their fields, people also eat them. So they have this very ambivalent relationship with them. On the one hand, they're a bit scared of them. On the other hand, well, more than a bit scared of them. On the other hand, they really look forward to them as really valued and delicious food. So, you know, the problem for me is I'm vegan, so I wasn't running around eating things. I was sort of trying to avoid eating things. But I did eat a couple of locusts, and they were, you know, crunchy.
They were crunchy.
Yeah.
Very good. Do people eat other insects? Thanks for the call, Rich.
They eat larvae for sure, and you know, there's certain places where people have a very developed insect cuisine. So the place that I think of first is Thailand, particularly northern Thailand.
Uh-huh.
And people eat all kinds of insects there, all kinds of larvae and caterpillars, but also beetles and spiders and scorpions and crickets.
Whatever moves gets eaten, right?
Pretty much, and you know, they have very complicated ways of cooking them as well, or just really probably delicious ways of cooking them if you're into that. Yeah.
Well, Hugh, you spent a significant chunk of time working with insects and people and insects, and did the question ever cross your mind, can these critters have sentience? Can they be knowing beings?
Yeah, constantly. That was a question I thought about a lot. And I tend to give animals the benefit of the doubt rather than assuming that they can't do things, that they can until it's demonstrated otherwise. So I think that there's all sorts of ways in which insects feel and think. It's just it might not be the same. I mean, I doubt that it's the same way that we
sure.
feel and think.
Sure.
I think it's probably other ways for a start. They have very different senses. You know, they see the world in really different ways because their eyes are structured very differently. They have, you know, they have, many have, you know, they have antennae, so they have, you know, they have a lot more sort of, what would you call it, cross-modal senses than we do, so that there's combinations of smelling and touching and particularly smelling and touching, I think, in ways that we don't have. So I think they're very much sensing the world and processing it, very much so, but just in ways that we don't understand. I suspect they also have emotional responses to the world, most animals that we know of do.
Mm-hmm.
Or certainly when we try to look for it, we find it. It's a question, I think, often of what we're prepared to look for.
And how we look at them.
Yeah.
Well, let me ask you this, one final quick question for Hugh Raffles, author of Insectopedia, a great read, have fun with it, take it to the beach. What do you think they think of us?
Good question, right? It probably depends what we're... Depends what we're up to.
I mean, we're barely cognizant of them. Do you think they're cognizant of us at all?
Well, I tend to think it's probably more indifferent than anything.
Okay.
I think they're probably getting on with their lives.
Getting on with their lives,
yeah.
Like, as we do with ours.
Exactly, yeah.
Hugh Raffles, thank you so much for joining us. Gosh, what's next? Another next decade, what are we going to be talking about, Hugh?
Well, I'll look forward to talking about it, whatever it is. Right now, I'm not completely sure because I'm still sort of decompressing from this one.
Good for you. All right, thanks for joining us, Hugh. Really appreciate your presence. And thank you out there for tuning in. Stay tuned next week for more What's Eating What Radio right here on The Food Chain. And join us on the forums at metroforum.com. Thank you.
You've been listening to the award-winning Food Chain Show with Michael Olson. If your friends missed the show today, tell them to log on to the radio page at www.metrofarm.com for a listen. Now go out and find some food with a farmer's face on it and live.